just there, you
yes,
know?
Yes.
So it made me...
You can ask for a straw with your drink.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I can ask, can you lift the glass? Can I have a different glass? Because this one's too thick and I can't handle it. And can you bring my plate to the table? And all sorts of things I could do.
Yes.
And without even looking around and seeing if anybody is listening, you know? Yes. And I felt free, if you like. And so with Jeff there and other people that I met there, I felt I wanted to contribute as well. So I got involved in that way, so much so that I got elected on the NAC as well.
Fantastic.
I did 2 years with the NAC. Now my subject after that became psychological issues. I went through a bad period where I met somebody and they really took advantage of me. And it affected me psychologically.
Is this a relationship?
Not a relationship, but a friend who took advantage of me.
How did you meet them?
Through another friend. Through another friend. And I've always been shy of men. Very shy, because I don't know what their reactions would be to me. I always felt that people were laughing behind my back anyway. That was always the feeling there. Sometimes I wouldn't care. But then sometimes if I liked that person very much, it hurt. So when this person took advantage of me, I just broke down. And I needed psychological help. It took me over a year to get that help.
Can you say a little bit more about, if it's not too painful, about that, how the person took advantage of you?
Well, pretended to be a friend. Pretended to be a friend. Pretended to like me. Pretended that they were, you know, they wanted to be a business partner. Took advantage money-wise as well. I was foolish. So that sort of advantage. I found out things about them that they just... The good thing that I found out was it wasn't just me that they were taking advantage of. Yes. There were other people that he'd done that to. And I'm still friends with him, but I keep away. But he tried to make me believe that I was mentally unstable. And I started believing that. I started believing it then.
Yes.
And I would hide it from my parents because I didn't want them finding out, because they didn't like that person. And I didn't want to get away from that person. Do you see? Because they had a hold on me. And so I got to a stage where I asked for... He would tell me if I don't get that psychological help, he's going to walk away. And that was my worst nightmare. And so I got... deep down, I knew I didn't need it. But I wasn't strong enough to do that. So I went to my doctor and I told him that this is what was happening. Didn't tell him the truth, of course, that I needed help. I was getting depressed, etc. And finally, a year later, they got me that help. By that time, I deteriorated a lot because bombardment from this person day in, day out, that, oh no, you're doing this, you're a liar, you need help. And in the meantime, he'd ask me for money. So it got to a stage where, you know, I was literally just thinking of committing suicide.
Oh, gosh.
Got to that stage. And hiding it from my parents was the hardest thing.
Yes.
Because they'd know there was something fishy going on.
How long did it go on for, that sort of cycle with that person?
2 years.
Right, that's a 2 years. Time.
Yes, it is.
And how did you break it? How did you stop?
I went to the psychologist at the local hospital. I was finally referred to the psychologist. I went on antidepressants, and I'm still on antidepressants because coming off it is not very easy. And the psychologist, I started talking about everything from... It started with him wanting to come to the psychologist. So I got to the psychologist and I would talk how horrible I am and what a liar I am, and I wanted to get out of that cycle. And then slowly the psychologist, I think, just it must have struck her that this man was manipulating. So she said, do you mind if you come alone? And I thought, oh, thank God she said it, not me, you know. So I went alone, and then she brought me out of it slowly, saying what's happening. And I told her, you know, I'm not going mad, and I'm not a liar, and I'm not a cheat. But this is, I just being, you know, I think I'm being manipulated. I think, I said. And she said, yes, you are, because you're quite a strong character otherwise. And you've got to get out of this, and I don't want you to bring him here anymore. And I want to talk to you.
It sounds like he was really trying to control you. I mean,
yes, absolutely.
To go to a meeting with a counsellor or a psychologist with you, I mean, how can you possibly speak freely when...
Because he wanted to know what I was saying.
Yes.
Yeah. And to him, the truth was that I was a manipulative liar. Mm. And that's what he wanted to prove to the psychologist, that that's what I am.
Yes.
And once I started visiting her on my own, I got the confidence back.
Mm.
And I just said, enough is enough. And I said to him, look, I can't do any more money. If you want to be my friend, be my friend. Otherwise, just walk away. And I got the strength to do that. But no, he still tries. Still tries. But up to this day. But he knows now I'm very strong.
Mm.
So he's changed his tactics. He wants to be very nice to me, etc.
Yes.
And not bring these subjects up. But I am very strong now. I've become even stronger because I'm looking after my mom, and I need to be there for her. She's my priority now.
Yes. So. And this guy, though, I mean, he was it ever, do you think, on his part, a romantic attachment to you?
He wanted me to believe that.
Yes.
So that the string wouldn't, you know, the rope wouldn't go. He wanted me to believe that.
Yeah.
And
because
he wanted me to believe that, and I was really low. I did believe it. And the thought of him leaving me was like, you know, that's it, life's finished.
Yes. And would that have been your first, in a way, your first serious relationship with a man, or did you...
No, I had a couple before, but they were serious, but it didn't affect me as much as this had. Because I was thinking, I have a very good friend, he'd take me to the theatre, and he got me involved with the theatre and music and this and that, and I was having a good time. Yes. And I thought, oh good, I've found a great friend here.
Yes.
But then I was paying for that friend in a way, wasn't I? And it wasn't just £10 here and £10 there, it was thousands and thousands.
It sounds absolutely awful. Thank goodness you got away from it.
He still tries. Still tries to manipulate me, but now he knows I've got that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Doesn't sound like he's got that like hand of control over you anymore.
No. And I'm not yes sir, no sir, three back. He would say to me, you know, I'm your boss. Like if we go into business together, I'll be the boss, but you put up the money. And thinking about it, I thought and thought and thought, and when I became stronger, I said, no way. If I'm putting up the money, you're working for me, you know?
Yes.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, absolutely.
So how can I be so foolish and let a man take over my life like that?
You wouldn't be the first person in the world.
I know. So that was actually quite comforting that it wasn't because of my disability.
Yeah.
Because I always thought that, you know, it was because of my disability. But that's comforting that you hear stories about this.
Oh, many stories.
Correct.
But in both directions, don't you? Sometimes we know it's women manipulating men. And,
yes.
You know.
Absolutely. Oh, yes. We've had that in the thalidomide community as well.
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. So obviously you haven't had children.
No.
So none of those questions apply. Would you have liked to have had children? Do you think you would have seen yourself as someone who got married and had children if you had a different life all over again?
I do wonder. I don't see myself, but I do wonder. Especially when I was I was bringing up one of my sister's sons. She has two sons, and he was at boarding school here in Epsom. So I was sort of mum to him because he came at 13. And I would go and pick him up every week and bring him home, take him shopping, feed him, buy his clothes, you know. But then, and then go and drop him off, and he'd ring me if he had a problem or anything like that. But that was, he was 13 then, and it was okay. I wasn't changing nappies or anything like that.
Yes.
I sometimes do wonder if I had brought, you know, if I had children, how would I have brought them up? Yes. If I had a husband, what kind of a husband, what kind of a life I would have had?
Yes.
Sometimes I wonder.
Yes.
then I think, oh, I'm so glad I didn't have to make those school runs and get up early in the morning and, you know, not have a husband that I have to ask things. You know, if I want to spend something, I don't have to ask anybody. I can go and do it myself, spend. Mm. How I want my house is up to me. Mm. What I want to eat is up to, up to me, you know.
Yes, so you've got quite a lot of freedom in a way.
Yeah,
in the way you choose.
I think once you get past that age of where you do want to get married, say in late 30s or early 40s, you've passed that age where you think, I'd love to get married and settle down and have children. Then you become selfish. Then you think, no, I'm really enjoying my life. I don't have to get up early in the morning. Don't have to cook if I don't want to. Yes. I can watch whatever channel I like. I can be at home or go out and stay out all night if I like, you know. Then I think after a certain age, you change your ideas and you think, no, it's a good thing that.
Yes, to have some.
And then the heartache of it, the children, the education, the marrying them off, the grandchildren, all the rest of it. It has its advantages and disadvantages. But if you find a good person, then it's a different thing.
Yes.
But if you're unlucky, and I always had the fear of somebody marrying me for the money and not myself.
I can imagine that.
And I think my parents always, my mother especially, always had that fear.
Yes.
So, you know, you don't have to get married and have a husband to have a good time anyway.
Exactly.
You know?
There's plenty of things you can do in life. And so for the sake of the interview, because I think we talked about this off before I started recording you, you live here at the moment with both.
They live with me, yes.
And you were telling me about your mum's stroke that she had recently. Mm. Could you tell me that again for the interview?
Yeah.
So you were, your mum was your main carer, you were saying.
Yes, she was. Although I do have a carer, but my mum was there all the time for me.
Yes.
In fact, we were more than daughter, you know, mother daughter relationship. It was more like now we were friends.
Yeah.
Getting to this stage, we did everything together. Like. If she went to India in a few weeks' time, I'd follow and we'd have a good time there. We had a pact that if she's in India, she took care of me there. And when she was here, I'd take care of her here, in the sense that I'd do all the bill paying and looking after and grocery shopping and all that in this house. Mm. And she'd do that in India.
Yeah.
So it was a holiday for her here and it was a holiday for me there.
Yeah.
And we were in business together as well, so she would handle my, the embroidery and the buying of the material and everything over there. And I'd send her designs and then she'd have them made for my clients. So we were in partnership in that way as well. And we became really good friends,
Amazing.
Unfortunately, I had a fashion show, in November, one of my very large fashion shows, with 200, 300 people attending. And for the very first time, my nephew was modelling. My sister's older son was modelling. I think she got a bit overexcited. And after the fashion show, she was just sitting in the chair and next thing she was on the floor. She was taken to hospital and they said she'd had a massive stroke. Three quarters of the left side of her brain was brain dead. In the hospital, the consultants told me that there was no chance of recovery. She was not, even if she did, she would be like a vegetable. And the best thing for me was to let her go. I couldn't believe it when they said that. I really couldn't believe it. And I totally refused. I said, whatever it takes, you have to keep her going. I'm not going to sign any no resuscitation order. Plus, knowing a little bit about the medical background, having my father to support me and my brother-in-law who's a doctor. My sister's a microbiologist, so we have a lot of medical background. And my brother-in-law was communicating with me every day, four or five times a day, about my mum. And he said, no way, don't let them do that. Don't you sign any papers or anything. And I said to the doctors that, no, I want to keep her going and see. 2 months down the line, they hadn't got her sugars under control. They hadn't got her physiotherapy. They hadn't got her anything at all. She's just lying there in bed, not able to do anything. The consultant called me and said he wasn't able to do anything for my mother anymore, and that either she should go into a nursing home or I could take her home, but they couldn't keep her anymore because there was nothing they could do. They'd done the best. The consultant, when she was about to be discharged, she got a high temperature and she had a diarrhea and she was on antibiotics, and the consultant wanted me to take her home in that state. And I told him that, look, people come into hospital in this stage. They don't go home in this stage. Nowhere am I taking her home. You first fix her. You first get her diarrhea under control, her temperature under control, and then I'll take her home. Her insulin and her diabetes under control, because she was staying very high. They were going to send her home on the Monday. And they finally, when I refused, they got it under control on a Thursday. And they said she's ready to go home on the following Monday. And I said, yes, I'm ready. You know, if she's ready, I'm ready. The consultant said to my sister, I think your sister's panicking now that she has to take her home. And I told the consultant, I've never panicked in my life. You know, I've had so much more to put up with than having my mum home in this state. Yeah. I've had a lot more going on in my life that I could have panicked at, which I haven't done, and this is nothing. I will take my mum home and I'll show you. And I brought her home 10 weeks after she'd been diagnosed and had her treatment. And she came home with a peg feed. You know what a peg feed is? Yes. With her diabetes way out of control, with her not able to turn in bed or anything, with her not able to eat, drink, not even drink, and not even able to talk, say anything at all, and drowsy all the time. In the 8 months she's been home, she now can turn over in bed. She's off the peg feed. She's eating by mouth. She's drinking with the cup. She's sitting up in bed for half an hour. We're standing her up for 5 minutes.
Yes.
And she's not talking, but she can make us understand what she's saying.
Yes.
And I took her to the hospital for an x-ray 3-4 weeks back, and we took her to the consultant, and I said, Mr. Cohen, this is my mother, and look what she said and look where she is right now. And my mother was thirsty, so she asked me for a drink. I gave her the drink and she drank, because he said to me, she'll never be able to drink out of a cup.
Yes.
And she drank, and he said, wow, that's amazing. He said, and that's family dedication.
Yeah.
And I said, well, you were saying that I wouldn't be able to cope.
Yes.
I've done much better than your hundreds of staff here would ever have done.
And isn't it interesting from your story, this whole circle where that a lot of the medical profession said with you, don't bother, just leave her.
Yeah.
And your family didn't give up on you.
Exactly.
And, yeah.
Yeah. And the other way as well, that she had to take care of me when I was born.
Yes.
It's come full round now, and she's getting older, I'm taking care of her.
Yes.
And in such a manner that, you know, she really is like a small baby now.
How aware do you think she is of what's happened to her? Do you think she's...
Yes, she's aware.
She's all there in her mind, but she can't communicate.
Not all there. She does forget.
Yeah.
But she's aware of what's happened to her because she cries.
Yes.
Especially when I'm looking after her, feeding her, or you know, giving her cuddles or anything. She really cries because she feels that she's meant to be taking care of me. And it's the other way around now. So, and I say to her often, I speak to her, I say, Mum, look, don't worry. You took care of me when I was little. It's my turn now. I have to give back something. And she cries and she laughs and then she gives me a hug, you know. So she is aware. She is aware. And she doesn't want anybody else but me. If I go out, she won't eat. If I'm, you know, even in another room, she'll cry so that I'll go running to her. You know, so she knows that this is my be-all and end-all of everything.
Yes.
And the roles have really changed. They've really reversed. Even with my dad, he's 87.
Yeah.
He relies heavily on me now.
Yeah.
He can't drive, so I have to take him to all his appointments.
Yes.
I have to park, drop him off at the hospital, tell him to wait there, go park the car, come back, get a wheelchair, put him in the wheelchair, and then take him to his appointment.
And how has he reacted to your mum's stroke?
He hasn't taken it very well.
No.
No. But he knows that if he breaks down,
yes,
then it's going to be very hard for me.
Oh, so it's been a really hard year for you.
Yeah. Oh, terrible year.
Yeah.
Terrible year. In the hospital where Mum was, I stayed there, you know, continuously at night. So again, because I can't go to the bathroom, the last thing my carer would do was 10 o'clock, she'd leave me and come here to look after my dad. So she'd take me to the loo at 10 o'clock, and then I'd drive home about 8 or 9 o'clock in the morning. Until then, I can't go to the loo. If I can't go to the loo, I can't drink. I mustn't drink, because then I'll want to go to the loo. So a lot of dehydration was taking place as well. Mm. And I'm diabetic as well. So it's been, like you say, it's been a really tough,
absolutely
tough 10 months.
Yeah.
But I'm not looking at those months that I went through. I'm looking at what I've achieved.
Absolutely. And what there is still to achieve.
Absolutely.
As well.
Yeah, absolutely. I know I can never get my mum back.
Yeah.
Fully get my mum back. Yeah. But whatever sort of quality of life I can give her is, you know, it would be amazing. And that's why I'm building the room and everything for her as well.
Ah, I was going to ask you what that building work was going on outside.
I'm building a room and a bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me, she's crying. Okay. Yeah.
Let me turn this
on. Sorry.
And we just went in to see.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we've just gone in to see Sukeshi's mum, who's drinking her milkshake from a cup and doing incredibly well, given that she had a stroke last November.
Yes.
Such a major one. And looking very comfortable in her luxury bed.
Oh, gosh, a hospital bed.
How about your health concerns? You did mention to me again earlier as we were coming in the car about pain. Now, like pain levels with your shoulders and your back. How has that changed over the years?
In fact, I didn't have shoulder pains and aches and up until a few years ago. I've also got neuropathy in the toes and the bottom of my feet as well. I keep getting cramps and pins and needles, and sometimes I can't feel the bottom of my legs. And I think a study has been done on thalidomides and relating to neuropathy. And I think it is, I don't know if it's proven or what, but it is part of thalidomide as well. Lots of us are suffering from it.
Yeah.
With the back, obviously we didn't get any training or any advice on how to bend and pick up things. And some of us have to bend very, very low. If I drop something, I have to get right down on my knees to pick it up and then bend over to pick it up. So, which isn't the ideal way of treating your back. Lots of us are using our feet to maneuver things or pick up things, etc. I'm finding it very difficult because I'm starting to lose. If I pick up something and want to get to it, find it very hard to balance now as well, on one leg. Find it very hard. I need the support of a wall or something like that to then get the thing from my feet. I'm also finding it, the lower back is very, very painful, especially when I've been through the day, and in the evening at night when I'm about to go to bed, it's excruciatingly painful. I don't like taking painkillers all the time, so try and avoid them as much as possible, and just go for the normal, you know, hot water bottle or something like that. But that's that's a short-term help. At this stage in our lives, or in my life, I think it's too late to do anything about the back.
Yes.
Or the shoulders. Again, it's the driving as well that doesn't help. But I used to be able to drive 2-3 hours at a stretch with no problem. But now 20 minutes, half an hour is more than enough before I start getting shoulder pain and back pain. So it's restricted me in you know, traveling as well.
And have you been able to see any medical professionals that could maybe specialize in your particular, you know, movement difficulties, what your, you know, which parts of your back you're overusing or overcompensating for your arms?
Yes, but the treatment is an ongoing treatment, which at the moment with my mother in her condition, I can't have.
No.
I can't spare the time.
No.
And although you get the treatment, you're basically still doing the same things. What you need to do is change how you manipulate things or pick up things. How do we change that?
That would be demand an awful lot of work and time.
Absolutely.
That you probably don't have right now.
And you know, gadgets and everything. And when you go out and I drop my handbag, I don't have a gadget to pick it up. Now I have to ask somebody, please, can you get it for me? Mm-hmm. Or I have to bend down and do it myself. And that puts your back in trouble again as well.
Yes.
So there's not sticks and stones and this and that and the other that you can carry around with you for all sorts of things.
No.
You know, how many gadgets can you have? You need to carry a suitcase with you.
It was Jeff, actually. He said when he was sent out of, I think it was Roehampton, and they gave him, I've forgotten what they call them now, the bag that you would put with arrows in.
Okay.
You know, like a
backpack
Robin
kind
Hood
of thing. Yeah,
no,
right.
It was like an arrow bag filled with gadgets. And his mum was saying, well, how's he going to carry that around
everywhere?
How's he going to know which one to get out?
Exactly. And how is he going to get it out, first of all? I mean, to get it out, he'd need to drop it on the floor. And
exactly.
You're going to be doing the same thing.
Look over his shoulder to actually find the right one.
Well, he won't be able to reach it anyway, because
exactly.
I know Jeff. And even I wouldn't be able to reach it. Sometimes human beings just don't think.
No, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And are you working right now?
Yes, I do my own private work.
Yep.
I'm also a chairperson of my local community ladies group. So we have about 2,500-3,000 members.
Wow.
And I organise programmes for that. We just had one recently on Saturday, which went really, really well. I've had so many congratulation phone calls. It's unbelievable.
Mm.
So I have to organise a programme every month.
Mm.
And that's where I'm at the moment. But 3/4 of my time during the day goes with my mum, feeding her, you know, making sure she's okay. Just like you saw just now, if I'm not around, she'll start crying.
Yes, She probably just, the sound of your voice is very soothing.
Reassuring to her that I'm around.
Yeah.
I don't even sleep in my own bedroom now. I sleep here on the floor.
Right.
So that I can keep an eye on her at night, and I have a baby monitor there so I can hear her.
That's very dedicated.
And she gets up about 3 or 4 times a night.
Right.
So, you know, every time she gets up, she wants me up as well.
Mm.
Sometimes.
What does she want from you when she gets up in the night?
Just to cuddle.
Just to hear your voice.
Just to cuddle as well, you know, just reassurance.
Yes.
And just to know that I'm here, I haven't gone anywhere.
Mm.
And it's nothing really major.
Mm.
I give her a cuddle and in 2 minutes she goes back to sleep again.
Mm.
Or sometimes she needs changing.
Mm.
Diaper needs changing. So
she's uncomfortable.
Yeah,
she's
if the diaper's wet, then you know you don't like, I mean, we don't like leaving her in it either.
No, of course.
And
not.
It's uncomfortable and
yes.
might give her rash and stuff and
yes.
make it worse for her.
Yeah.
So
gosh, you've really got your work cut out at the moment.
Yeah,
haven't you?
Yeah.
And one of my final questions is, what are your hopes and wishes for the future? I suppose you're just tied up with the present, aren't you, at the moment?
I am at the moment. For me, at the moment, my goal is to get my mother as well as possible.
Yeah.
And I don't think about me at the moment. I don't think about my aches and pains. You know, they'll always be there, like, you know, they're not going to go away that easily. But at the moment, my ambition is to get my mum as well as possible.
Yes.
Get her a quality of life.
Mm-hmm.
And then think about me, because I know all her life she's thought about me. And it's time somebody thought about her as well.
Yes.
It's sad that I have to do it at this stage where she's not well.
Yes.
I wish I could have done it when she was well and taken the load off her mind.
Yes.
But, you know, your child is always your child, whether they're going to be 80 or 90 or 50 or whatever.
Absolutely. And they still look like they still look like a little baby to you.
That's
they?
Right.
People
yes.
say,
yes.
You know, you still see the little child inside
absolutely.
Them.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I'm appreciating that more now than I used to.
Mm.
I used to get quite embarrassed when she would treat me like a little girl or a little baby, you know.
Yes.
But I'm appreciating it more now.
Mm.
And, you know, mother's love is, you never find it anywhere else.
I agree.
Never, never.
Yeah. Your feelings and thoughts about thalidomide in general, now you're older and now you've probably learnt a lot more about the origins of the drug and
yeah.